And when you teach it that way, by saying to a child and to their stakeholders, their guardians, teachers, parents, look, we want your child to be able to get out of a situation before it even starts. So let's say we now got to the stage where they are being approached by a potential threat, whether it's a bully, contemporary bully, or a much larger bully, or a predator of some sort, whether it's a child child on child predator, or a teenage on child predator, or an adult on child predator. You know, they've understanding what the warning signs are with that person. That's all part of their fence. It's all part of them understanding, listening to their instincts. You know, their warning signals that are going off. What things to spot? People's behaviours, and keeping that person at a distance and making and manufacturing distance in front of them. Again, all the time accessing exit points for them. When that exit point is no longer accessible, immediately at least anyway, it's going to all be about getting to that exit point by whatever means necessary in the situation and whatever means reasonable. And when you start getting all that and you're building up this whole thing, you actually train it. You don't give it lip service. You know, this is again, a big part of the problems that you find within self-protection teaching is this lip service that people give to things. You know, people, you know, don't, you know, they'll tell you about awareness, but they won't do any activities that promote awareness. They won't tell you how to train awareness as part of your everyday behavior. They, although at least it, or when they do, what they often do is it comes back to our old problem with paranoia and hypervigilance. You know, what they teach you is a type of unworkable and therefore unlikely to maintain behavior. You know, walking down, you know, commentary walking has its place. It's a good, you know, it can be a good form of personal training, but you're not going to be commentary walking as you go about your everyday with other people. You know, you might try and, but what you can do is say, right, well, you know, just as I lock my front door, just as I put my seatbelt on, I will, when I go into an unfamiliar situation, or a new situation, you know, that's outside of my home, or even in my home where something changes. You know, let's not forget that domestic violence is one of the big areas that people like to gloss over in self-protection. You know, there are a lot of martial artists don't like to address, you know, the fact that, you know, so you've kind of got that as well. So whenever a situation is changing, you know, we go into a code orange, or, you know, to use Jeff Cooper's terminology, you're adopting, you know how to be able to go to that code orange, as in you know how to escalate your awareness level. Because why? Because you're taking in your surroundings, you know, and you're going to accommodate for different things. It's all right saying to a kid or even an adult, well, quite simple, don't pay attention to your mobile phone. Don't, you know, all this stuff. You know, I remember seeing a driver awareness course where you listen to the person who's running that course will tell you, essentially, when you drive your car, you should have no distractions on. You should not use any form of satellite navigation. You shouldn't be having any, you should have your mobile phone switched off. Never mind, you know, not answering it. It should be off so that no one can ring you in the car. So, you know, it doesn't matter about hands-free and all that sort of side of it. Also, if you know that you shouldn't be paying attention to that, you shouldn't be paying attention to anyone, you shouldn't be talking to anybody in the car. And you're going, really? Yeah, you know, this this is going to be maintainable, isn't it? You know, this is going to be working like that. So likewise, you know, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, you know, electronic devices are part and parcel of our life, our society, and certainly young people. So again, it becomes a case of like, okay, we've got to accommodate for that. So how did it happen? You know, if you're going to answer your phone, put your back to a wall, look at it and look up. You know, I think, again, back to one of my coaches, Moti, gave an example of you being on holiday on the beach. You know, you can be on holiday on the beach, but you're in an unfamiliar surrounding, okay? It's going to be, likelihood is it's going to be safe. Why? Because it's still part of the developed world. It's still the tourists that are there are being looked after to a certain degree and things like that. But you're on the beach and you're relaxing. That's the point. You're on holiday. You know, you don't want to be on the beach constantly scanning for the new threat that's going to come, that's going to happen. You know, someone's going to attack you on the beach. You know, you've heard about these crimes and people have been murdered on the beach and mugged on the beach, raped on the beach. So therefore you're looking out for them. So that's going to happen. No, you're sat on the beach, you're either on your phone, on your device, reading a book, and that kind of thing. But then you have to say, okay, well, we're going to have to adopt some habits that are going to accommodate for that. So the point is that you will read or look at your device or something for a period of time and look up, you know, periodically throughout it, you know, as regular intervals. That becomes part of what you do. And that's not a big ask to make of a person, really, to be honest, because even when somebody sunbathes, unless they nod off, the chances are they're going to be that they're going to be aware of noises that go around, new changes of noises and sounds that are going on around them. They are going to respond to that. And so that's the same thing. So again, when your vision's being obscured, you know, because you're reading or watching something, you know, you can periodically just give yourself a regular habit of looking up and scanning and looking up and around the place and just taking on board what's going on. And, you know, it's not that difficult to put into a person's behavior. It's being able to teach that kind of thing and not giving it lip service. So, and again, by not giving something lip service in training, and certainly in children's training, and by turning it into fun activities, as well as being very real about what the threat they're facing is, the nature of that threat they would do, and what they're going to need to do to physically defend themselves, you also are putting across to them and to their stakeholders that their soft skills are being taken seriously, that we're doing everything we can to avoid or mitigate a physical assault. We are not just teaching a person to brutalize another human being because they're scared of them, you know, or because they think they're a threat of some sort, things like that. So so again, you talked about, you know, making it fun, you know, because you say you've got your own daughter and you're interested in anti-bullying and how you teach and make it fun. Which I think, again, brings me back to my club before I even wrote the book. And what I noticed was, again, another problem that we found within martial arts clubs and self-protection clubs, especially for kids, was the prevalence of games. You know, games were a good idea because they kept the from a business point model, again, you know, keeps the kids, brings them in, whatever, you know, but then you'd look at it and you go, you know, you take your kid to play tennis, you know, for a tennis coach. You'd be pretty miffed if that tennis coach had that kid then play volleyball for most of their game, or play rounders, or played a chase game, or anything else other than teaching that child tennis. You'd be pretty annoyed with. And the same with swimming. You know, you get the kids in the pool, and as you know, leave kids, especially kids who haven't learned how to swim yet, you know, to their own devices. And they'll happily just splash around and muck around in the pool and won't be interested in doing lengths. You know, a lot of adults are the same. You know, you've been with enough adults on, on holiday where, you know, they've been in the swimming pool and the last thing they want to do is go up and down the pool swimming. You know, they just rather just soak it up, just cool, sunbathe and then cool off in the pool and then come back in and sunbathe and chat to a few people around the pool and, you know, and do that. They're not interested in doing that part of it. But, you know, if you took your kid to swimming lessons and you found out that that's exactly what they were doing in the pool, again, you'd be going, I can do this myself. Why am I taking to that? And the same thing I was finding with martial arts classes. And we shouldn't be surprised because it happens with the adults as well to a certain degree, except for with the adults, they do it in the form of, a lot of the time in the form of calisthenic exercises. With the kids, you'd go to their typical class and it happened right across the martial arts spectrum, you know, all of them were, you know, starting to do it. And because they worked out, they went, okay, the kids get bored with doing the martial arts techniques. So what we'll do is we'll do some other games with them. We'll get to play, they can play a bit of football, they can throw the ball and they can do this sort of thing. So, you know, bear in mind, you know, the average kid's lesson is rarely going to be over an hour anyway. You know, the average kid's lesson is often half an hour to three quarters of an hour. And to be honest, in hindsight, you know, my lessons were too long, and you know, half an hour to 45 minutes is pretty good for a child's attention span. That's when I do seminars for kids, you know, I make sure I slice those seminars up with good break periods in between, because I want to keep them interested, and I make sure that there's a lot of different media that they're dealing with, you know, so they can, again, to keep that interest. So you've got the games in there to make the martial arts stuff less boring. Okay, you already, I already see a problem with that idea. So the instructor's accepting that the kids are going to find the martial arts boring. Okay, so rather than make the martial arts more interesting and more enjoyable, or most importantly, making the important skills they're going to get from martial arts more accessible to for a younger person, they think, well, I'll tell you what we'll do, we'll bribe them with the games, and that literally has often been the case. It's been you've got instructors saying, get your punch really good, get your reverse punch really good, or get this kick really good, or get this throw really good. If everybody does that, we can all play a game of volleyball or something. We can do that, and that then becomes the bribe, and you're going, but you're immediately vilifying the martial art. You're immediately pulling the martial art down, and the same happens with self-protection. So I looked at it and went, well, okay, well, games work. Kids naturally do it. We like to play as a species, and so I thought, well, make the games relevant. As simple as that. The challenge is to make the games relevant. And there are certain kids' games that actually have a relevance to self-protection. And it doesn't mean that everybody who does those kids' games is going to automatically be better equipped for self-protection. What it means is that you can, it's up to you to make that connection. Yeah, the odd kid will. The odd kid will work out that hide and seek can be a great way to get away from a predator. That tag is a great evasion game and a great tactical escape game. It can be. So you take those games and you immediately you start it off in their rawest sense, their absolute, the way that they can relate to, and then immediately you then start layering on really relevant material, and you can turn that into an exercise where the kids not only learn how to avoid likely attacks, how to avoid predatorial behaviors and physically defend against that, but also the kids who then play the roles of the predators and the threat, they start to see it through the enemy's eyes, if you know what I mean. They understand, right? Yeah. That's why I went after that particular individual, because they were doing this. They're either not paying attention, or they have the unfair disadvantage of being smaller than the other kids, or something like that. And there's lots of stuff in there. You can bring in how to defeat bystander effect. That's why, that's a great way to invest parents and instructors. You get them to play the role of the bystander, and they can only assist the kids that properly address them, that properly lock eyes and order them to do something and things like that. And you get the kids also to learn how to work as, to not be bystanders themselves, to work as a group. Because to begin with, you start seeing straight away, everybody is all it's every kid for themselves, and they all get picked off. This is what happens. They get picked off in TIG or Bulldogs or whatever game it happens to be, the variation, whatever chasing game it is in teaching. They early on they notice this, get picked off because they all just spread up, they split up. They always find it. I don't know when your podcast is going to be going out, but when it comes to a horror movie, people always, there's so many mistakes that happen in a horror movie that people scream at the screen, go, how stupid that person is. And actually, as you've gone through time, you start realizing, well, actually, that's fairly realistic. People do split up. This actually does happen in a predatory thing. People do that. Unless they've got training as a group, they often will split up. And people do get picked off in that way. So there's that part of it. So it's the defeating the bystander, and it's working as a group, and it's teaching, again, all the time, all these extra skills. But most importantly, the kids tell it back to you. They tell you what worked for them, what didn't work for them, why a certain individual was picked on. So that is just, that is a great way to, but as I said, back to the point, the challenge for the instructor, for the teacher, for the coach, is to work games in that will have a direct relevance. And that then has an influence over adult training. Because what I started noticing with adult training was that too much of a martial art class and too much of a self-protection class was dedicated to exercises that, although have what could have benefits for those participating and have abstract benefits, shall we say, or indirect benefits, that there were things that could easily be done away from that class. I mean, you know, I can make an argument for so many things being connected to self-protection or martial arts. You know, you could very easily go through, and again, we used to sometimes do this in a lesson with kids, where you'd go, name a subject that you really don't like. And then I would, you know, it would be a challenge for me to connect that subject to martial arts. Or it would be, just name a subject you think has got nothing to do with martial arts, and then you'd be able to do that. You know, you'd be able to explain, you know, all the different subjects. And you'd find that really, and they'd really work hard to come up with, you know, trigonometry or something like that. You know, there would be, how could that possibly, have a connection? Trying to study our solar system and galaxies. What relevance has that got to martial arts or self-protection? Which then become a challenge for yourself to do that. Yeah. But which is great. I mean, that's fine. But then again, you also have the problem with doing stuff that is abstract in training that shouldn't be high on your priorities. So this is why I developed like the hierarchy of training. That's in my Mordred's victory book, a hierarchy of training where you prioritize certain training activities above others, because this, again, often I felt was a problem with martial artists and self-protection, whichever area you want to look at it. They were infected with a lack of knowledge on what would directly help them. Therefore, they went to other areas. And rather than looking at the other areas and saying, how can I adapt those other areas better to suit the training I'm doing? Or looking at the training you're doing and thinking, what connections that got that would better improve that kick, that better improve that throw, that would better improve our sense of awareness, that would better improve our knowledge of our attackers and things like that, you know. So again, so, you know, that all became relevant. And on a physical level, that went right down to exercises. That went down to not just having people run around the dojo or gym, but to immediately work on footwork if they were doing martial arts, or tactical escape if they were doing self-protection. Yeah, and so on a physical, so that influenced. So the stuff that I learned from the kids influence the adult training, so that you end up with a type of time managed, specific, tailored training that is going to make most efficient use of the training time that a person has got, rather than just you hear all this sort of stuff like people doing, you know, they do press ups as part of their warm up, and you're going, so a press up, you're trying to tell me a press up is less physically demanding than a punch? Where's the mentality of that? You know, if you're warm enough to do a press up without pulling a muscle, then you're warm enough to hit a pad. You're warm enough to shadow box. You're warm enough to spar. You know, so it didn't used to make a lot of sense to me, and it just seemed to be a lot of instructors trying to fill in time. You know.
I know all about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
you know, if you're, yeah.
Yeah. I remember when I was teaching. Well, we're doing this dodgeball. As a part of the warm-up, so it's like avoid getting hit but again, it's quite interesting to hear, because I think that's a common problem again, that they have to fill it in time management, fill in a lot of nonsense that isn't relevant.
Or at least not directly relevant. As I said, it's an interesting exercise to get people to connect other things, and it's great to have people explore other areas within the mindset of martial arts, because again, a lot of martial artists are also become quite insular, I think, in their thinking too, and they're not aware of other things, you know. So for example, I'm surprised the amount of people who are seriously interested in teaching modern self-protection, but yet have no real interest in looking at criminology, have no real interest in looking at psychology or looking at
precisely
exactly, you know, they're not that stuff just doesn't You know, they'd rather be more interested in learning in thinking about historical samurai duels or match fights, you know, or anything like that on the other side of it. You know, when it comes down to it, they're not, their mind is not looking at, well, what is, okay, so you want to deal with a modern enemy. So do you know what the modern enemy really is, you know, outside of your own personal experience? Because again, this is the other thing. It's like, you know, we can't, it's a hard job to, certainly with self-protection, and kids will, you know, get this with you. When you are not connecting to them, when you're not empathizing with their situation, you're actually prescribing it from your own biography, or you're relating it to what your teacher has learned and their own experiences and things like that. You know, you're not stopping and thinking, well, okay, well, this is how is your average, you know, what are the physical threats that a school child is likely to face? Yeah. Where's their situation? And this is just it, isn't it? Because you can teach a child, you know, things like roughhousing between their friends, which I think is a very healthy pastime. And I think it's, you know, it's part of growing up. It's what kids do. It's how kids learn a lot of things about each other, and then including helping to build their own boundaries and stuff. Being able to say, I've had enough. You know, sometimes it can be as simple as that, going, I don't like that. You know, I've had enough of that. I don't want it anymore. That's, so there are things like that can come out of it, but also they toughen up a bit as well. You know, so, you know, it's, you know, part and parcel of, you know, being able to take the knocks and blows of life in general as well. So there is a degree of that. So I don't think it's, you know, I think that's fine as an activity. It's something that you're going to have a hard job ever trying to stem as far as people are social. It's clearly part of our growing up and social part of it. But really, we should then look at things like that and say, okay, well, how can we use that as a better learning experience as martial arts teachers, as self-protection teachers? You know, if kids naturally wrestle with each other, then great. You know, then let's turn that into a game where they can learn better maneuvering, to learn what it's like dealing with a resistant enemy, that's coming at you, and and also not to get drawn into things as well. You know, again, that starts becoming all part and parcel. You've got to say, no, well, if you don't want to fight, then you don't have to fight. It's like don't feel that you should be strong enough to deal with the social stigma of being able to walk away from a fight. You know, otherwise, you know, what's that teaching you as you get older, as the stakes get higher and things like that? And also being able to spot the dangers presented to kids by older kids. You know, this is a common recurring theme I come across all the time. I love using children's stories, whether they're fairy tales or novels or things like that. And I think I did a whole podcast about Pinocchio, using Pinocchio as my metaphor or my parable, if you like, about getting into bad company, essentially, you know, and where it can lead a person, you know, where individuals can be drawn into bad company. They aren't the initiator of the trouble. And they're not suddenly looking for the trouble, but they feel through peer pressure they have to be a part of it, and then they become a victim. And you know, there's been so many different cases of that. And the Pinocchio story is a great story for demonstrating that. You know, it's quite a dark tale. The actual original version of it, the very original one, was incredibly dark. But even the actual novel, it ends with Pinocchio being hung from a tree, and that's it. You know, because he got into the bad company, he got into under bad influences. But the actual novel itself, that it developed into, and they got rid of that unhappy ending. Well, you know, he got rescued and got another chance, but then he still made the same, you know, still made mistakes again. And you know, it's a wonderful story about growing up, you know, I think in many respects. I appreciate coming from a 19th century point of view, but there are some, you know, fairly robust principles there that most people I think can agree upon. And it's great about learning from mistakes, but also very much about watching out for the lampwicks in this world, watching out for people of the same age as you or a little bit older who might pull you into something that's dangerous. And again, because we see this all the time, don't we? Whenever you look at some tragedy involving children, that has been, you know, crime's been involved, whether it's been being groomed or whether it's a bullying incident or a hazing incident that gets out of control or whatever it is, in that way, it's usually a story about peer pressure and how someone gets drawn into a bad environment and how, you know, adults also use their own, Charles Dickens in this instance with Oliver Twist, they've got their Archful Dodgers, haven't they? Their procurers, who are often other children that draw them into, dangerous situations, whether it is getting the children to commit crimes for them or whether it's children getting abused. You have that situation where you've got the Artful Dodger procurer individual, trying to do that. So it's always good to be able to use that kind of sort of material, to best explain, because, when I look back at it, there are so many great self-protection parables and fables, that have been taught, since the earliest records, that again, which we can pull from because there are universal problems within human society and dangers that happen there. So we can cite and we can pull upon those. And again, I say a common one all the time is this getting involved in bad company and being able to teach that in a group, which then again comes back to our boundaries and fences again. A child can go, okay, this was fun, but now I'm not comfortable with this part. Whatever this is in a stage of a relationship. So because as we know, a lot of predators are likely to be a person that a child will know an adult will know for that matter. Boundaries again, all really, really important, it's going to be that as well. So it's going to be, getting that in as well.
It's quite interesting. Yeah. Because suddenly this, when one can put it out that we're teaching them how to avoid, well, personal protection, it has a wider and a broader range. It isn't only the physical, but it's the soft skills as well.
Definitely, yeah.
Where most parents will think, oh no, I'm not going to let my child learn self-protection skills because it's martial arts, it's violent.
Yeah.
And that's the common, that's the usual answer we get.
Yeah.
Well, they are afraid.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of parents they're not aware of this as well.
No.
Because, again, I see posters. There's a martial arts center right where I live. And they're, the way they're marketing is, what I look at it, is fear-based.
Definitely.
And it's a huge problem.
Because it perpetuates that same problem. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, because then us two are, I've changed. I haven't taught martial arts or self-protection classes for kids because I had to just stop because I saw, okay, suddenly the ones I was teaching, it was my nephews. They became, sort of violent, but not because I was teaching them how to become non-violent, but again, where they're growing up and all that, and their parent, who are they looking at it? Into who are their peers, who are their friends, and that affects them badly. So I just decided, okay, I'm not going to teach this anymore. But that's, again, it has nothing to do with me. I was teaching them how to protect themselves, it didn't matter, even if it were some kids I was teaching my nephews, and some of them they stopped, and then I was teaching some others, and
again, it's easy to look for that as being the reason behind it. I mean, I once had a parent tell me that they were having trouble controlling their kids back at home, not violent, but just misbehaving.
Yeah, misbehaving. And
as punishment, they were going to take them out of their martial arts class. Yeah. So you're thinking, that's really addressing the problem here. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the kids were, they were unhealthy, clearly there were, there was an unhealthy home life going on as well in some respects. I mean, nothing serious from what I could see, but what do you know? But there was definitely, an issue going on there, and they were having trouble with their discipline. Yeah. I mean, you can't, a lot of parents again love offloading their kids for an hour a week. And say, right, learn discipline. And you go, yep. So whatever I teach them, whether it's a self-protection or whether it's a martial art or whether it's the byproduct of discipline from the lesson is going to be no good at all. If as soon as they get back home, everything else is completely undermined. Whatever's going on is being undermined. So, and then, you know, their main source of influence, whether I like it or not, is going to be first their peers and second their parents. You know, so it's, you know, these are going to be the areas that can affect a child in the formative years. They'll only, you know, again, so that's why you need that support from the parents. You need that. You need to make sure that they're in on all this to say, well, guess what? You're investing as well. This is not just another pastime. This is just not, you know, one of the list, you know, that, you know, to keep your kid occupied. You know, this is, you know, something that I'm very serious about and I want to do my best with. And, you know, I find that, you know, when I'm teaching in schools, this is something I've really made clear to when I'm teaching teenagers to say, you know, because some teenagers or especially if I'm teaching at a school that I've been booked to do, you get some that have chosen because this is what they want to learn and they're honestly interested in learning it. You've got others who have chosen it because they don't like any of the other choices that are there. Okay, quite simply, they often see, for some reason, they're going, well, I'm not a hockey player, I'm not a football player, I'm not a tennis player, I'm not a, well, whatever the season it happens to be at that time, you know, and they go, right, so what I want is, you know, I'll do self-protection because that looks like, for some reason, looks like an easy option.
Well, it's, I really enjoy this, well, hearing what, how you've been teaching, because I can see myself and what I've done wrong, and now I've focused on studying, learning more about the psychology part, and this part, like in my podcast, I've spoken with a top criminal psychologist. He's from London, Mark Phillips from London, Wing Chun. So, and I've to see the importance of, okay, how can one connect things that the kids know, because the kids, they know what they want to learn, instead of us being the dominant superior.
Yes.
Which I've seen so many times, sadly, in the area I live, where they're teaching self-defense and learning from Richard Dimitri and yes, talking with Mary. And I really enjoy it because, and then I can reflect as I'm listening to others and hearing how you've been teaching and the importance of, I can learn from it as well. So
definitely. I mean, it does sound pretentious, but the children do teach it. They feed it back to you because the questions they ask, and it's a reality of their situation, you know, that can give to you. I mean, one of the things that I've said, you know, going back to the whole natural physicality between children and part, as part of social upbringing, what a lot of adults often fail to realize is that an average child's day, right up until their teens, their late teens, when they leave school, is very physical. You know, their chances of getting involved in some form of physical confrontation are about 50-50 compared to the average adult, which is, you know, minuscule in comparison.
I know all about it.
My
years at not college, but high school.
And it's any surprise that then, if that same sort of physicality is going on to children right up to the age of 16, 17, or even 18, when they're in high school, when they're in whatever the equivalent is, that when they go into colleges and universities, that then suddenly there are these real problems with their boundaries, physical boundaries between, you know, even then, and with, you know, obviously, you know, more mature students now, you know, and having a, where the physical risks are higher as well, and all this sort of thing going on. So, you know, it's not surprising. And again, that coming back to the whole thing about, you know, crime and things, on that basis, yes, we may look at things statistically and definitely don't want to get into hypervigilance and paranoia in terms of, you know, protection against crimes, but in terms of unreported crimes that go on at school, that I think is an elephant in the room. I think that is that is something that is often glossed over by so many people. When as you can relate to, physical confrontation is a strong likelihood for the children going through schools from right up until high school and sort of secondary school, and then even going on into college or university. So And these are unreported crimes, and they'll happen in any type of school, whatever school you're in. Yes. You know, this stuff is happening. It's because it goes from, you know, innocent sort of roughhousing, which again, it's, as I said, you know, is a, you know, part and parcel of development, and it has lots of benefits to it, and it can be managed right the way up to crossing boundaries. And assaults, you know, again, the average thing that a child puts up with, if the average child that comes back home and reports what's happened in their day, honestly, you could probably see various instances of what you would call varying degrees of assault if it was done to an adult. You know, the simply fact that, you know, a child can be going down a hallway and another kid will just come up and punch him in the arm or shove him. Why? Just because they can, because they want to. Now, you change that to an adult walking down the street, and another adult is coming up and just punching them because they can, and it's passed off. That, you know, that's an average day for a child. That's something that the average adult in a developed world and in an area with low crime rates, they might not experience that in their entire life, and anything like that, anything close to that kind of situation. Yeah, so yeah, it's part of an everyday. Of an average day for a child in any school across the world, no matter what, no matter how good a reputation that school has got, or what area of society or class it is supposed to represent.
Yeah. So it's like when it comes, I don't have any questions actually, but so it's more. So the problem is, how come, for us who are trying to teach self-protection, in we have, well, our competitor, I was calling competitors, who are using fear-based marketing.
Yes.
How should we approach it then? Because I've tried to put out a seminar, well, and self-defense course, put up a poster at the university, and there were no response. I don't know.
Oh dear. Okay. Yeah. No. I have to say. My marketing is very much a work in progress. You know, there's a good reason I don't teach a regular class anymore. Mm. So on the advertising front, that's why now I only teach private clients and seminars and courses. You know, things like that. You know, so I don't have that problem with trying to appeal it to the general public, because I'm either, you know, my clients are either individuals who are purposely seeking out these type of services, or instructors who know their school needs it. You know, they know it's something that's missing, even though they've got those students with them at the time, so they can say, we need to cover this. This is an important part of your training. And so they've already got that captive audience, if you know what I mean, in order to do that. So yes, the advertising marketing part of it, yeah, that is hard. I mean, the best I can see is by looking towards the clients who book me for those sort of things. And that is maybe not to do what I tried to do, which was, you know, run a class that is supposedly based on self-protection and then mixed martial arts as a form of attribute training, but rather use the martial art, the popular martial art that you might want, that you're teaching as your base, and then offer self-protection as a bolt-on course, as an extra course. Again, this is something which I'm working to develop at the moment. You mentioned Mary Stevens. She's well ahead of me on this one, in the respect that she wants to develop a badges course for children's self-protection that can be used as part and parcel of a martial art. So instructors then don't have to change their martial art. They don't have to change their system or whatever. All they do is they just then have a course. They have a separate course that they can run. And you can offer that as an extra service as part of it, because, say, to teach a self-protection as its own thing, well, yes, there are plenty of martial arts that have ended up making that be their be-all and end-all of what they do. You know, Krav Maga, they're all ones that come under the what I call the reality-based self-defense world. You know, there's that particular grouping. So there is definitely that, but as you point out, that's mainly targeted at adults. You know, it's you know, it's controversial for kids. But also I often find that martial arts, there's a lot of good that comes from it, But I find that a lot of reality-based self-defense falls into the same problems that they criticize of the martial arts and becoming, because they become a martial art. They become that. They can't resist it. It then becomes and I tried to do it with my own club. I mean, I'm just as guilty as they are in that respect. I tried to have things in place to stop it from becoming a style. You know, I said I listed no techniques, you know, I only had principles and strategies that would teach and be reflective, and ran it along those sort of lines and tried to use activities to quarry techniques. I did the best I could with that, but it wasn't commercially very successful at all. Maybe it would have been better if I, had invested more money in it, or even more and more time, you know, because again, I was balancing other jobs and things like that as well. But in the end, when I finished my club, and I learned so much from the teaching and from the kids at the time, but when I finished it, it was, the objective had changed. I said to myself, I want to be a personal trainer, and I want to be a seminar teacher. These are the areas that I want to do, and I want to have time to be able to write about this kind of material as well. So that's what I did. So I stopped running a regular club. So from trying to sell that from a pure point of view, yes, you could try to go the Krav route, but I'm not. But that looks like the most successful from that point of view to get people in. But personally. And I think as a good way to keep self-protection contained, because self-protection for me is a minimalistic modernist philosophy. You know, I think if there's anything backing behind it, it's based on trying to be very, very time efficient with what we're teaching in terms of self-protection, and to do our best not to teach too much, because we want things that are going to be very low maintenance and not going to get confused with multiple answers to multiple problems, more a case of this is an overarching strategy that allows for adaption, allows for flexibility. But bottom line is you've got some very easy to stick to core principles that are universally represented, and have that within a course. And that really, self-protection for any individual should be taught in the same way as a first aid course is taught. It should be of a similar length of time. You know, a first aid course up to 10 hours, your average basic self-protection course should be around about the same, with homework to do, 10 hours of actual on-the-spot training. And then, but here's research for you to go off and do, and, including, stuff for the kids to do, easy, accessible material for them to consume that they can learn back at home as well to enhance their soft skills and to make it part of their behavior, just to tell them that this is, what to do. You don't need, and then there should be refresher courses for self-protection. But again, it's my approach. And the main class probably should be a martial arts system, which is, it's going to be, by comparison, it's going to be a lot wider, a lot broader. And you then also don't have to get bogged down with, if you like martial arts, this is from that point of view, if you actually like martial arts, you don't have to be worrying with this situation where you're going, but this is what you do in real life, and this is not what you do in real life, and this is for sport, and this is for self-protection. And you can then go completely into saying, okay, we know what we're doing today. We're doing karate. We know what we're doing today. We're doing kickboxing. We're doing BJJ. We're doing wrestling. We're doing kickboxing. We're doing kung fu, whatever you're dealing with that particular thing. And you're going, when you're doing your, someone's doing their Filipino screamer stuff, they're not thinking about, okay, well, this is my knife defense. This is my, the skills they get from that will serve as useful attributes, but they're not having to worry about it when they're doing their hubud drill. But what would really happen? I mean, I'm not defending against the sewing machine attack. I'm not defending against the most likely type of stabbing attack. No, what I'm doing here is I'm developing a flow and dexterity drill that's going to improve my art of Excrema or Kali. But when I do my self-protection course and I come back to it, I then can say, all of a sudden I've got, better dexterity and better sort of familiarization with dealing with edged weapons. So although I might not be using the skills directly, what I've just done from there, they've certainly enhanced what I'm doing there. Similarly, again, it's the same argument I always teach when I do attribute training with boxing. You go away through boxing to become a boxer, to fight like a boxer, to fight other boxers, and to get the rich benefits of the modern version of boxing, which is unparalleled in terms of footwork and head movements concerned, and also in developing punching, but can't be transplanted verbatim, or shouldn't really be transported verbatim onto the hard skills of self-defense. What happens is that when you go to do the physical self-defense stuff and you do a universal type of strike, like a straight right or a straight left if you're left-handed, then what you've learned in boxing with your crosses and your overhands and your straight rights and straight lefts is it's going to improve it. It's going to suddenly improve that palm strike, you know, that power slap that you're using in self-defense, use a self-defense term, that gets you, that power slap will be greatly enhanced from learning how to hook properly in a boxing condition. You'll then be able to, so it's understanding that. So for me, my advice would be, unless you're really going down a proven franchise route, or you're going to say, I'm doing my own self-defense franchise and learn skills from the way Krav Maga and KZ and Defense Lab and things like that have used, that, you know, been able to market what they do, you want to, you know, use those as the model to do that. And unless you're actually going to completely embrace that kind of route, which I believe it comes with its own pitfalls, as I say, because I think inevitably, my argument is inevitably it becomes a martial art. It's not to say that stuff out of that is not really good. It's not to say that there aren't some excellent instructors in there. And I there certainly is. You know, I've had personal experience and befriended them and worked with them and taken stuff from what they've taught me involved in that. So it's not putting that off. But at the same time, I've seen too many examples of that kind of training immediately become martial arts, because self-defense and self-protection has to be limited by its very nature. It has to be a very limited, minimalized thing. Our job is to strip things down. It's not to add things to it. It's to, keep working to come up with a robust, small number of techniques and principles and strategies. So my view would be, you would offer your self-protection as an extra course, as a separate course, and then have what's going to pull people in is the martial art, unless it's the same, since it's you're going to borrow that reality based self defense promotion model.
Something to think about.
It's just a perspective I look at. I took it from a services point of view. You know, my attitude was like, I had people who wanted everything, but they didn't. You know, they really wanted to do kickboxing, but they wanted to have the reassurance that the kickboxing was going to serve them as a self-protection method. And so I had to come up with a cold thing of saying, no. If you want kickboxing, it's because you want to do kickboxing. You want to do Muay Thai. You want to do stand-up fighting. This is what you want to do. And we're doing it as a sport, and we're learning it as a sport. And there'll be no discussion about it working in that thing. And I'm not going to commit what I believe to be a trade description felony by telling you that it's going to help you in a that I'm teaching it to help you in a self-protection situation. You'll learn self-protection. This is what you've got to do. This is your self-protection course. You know, so decide what your purpose is and what you're going to do. And I remember even teaching that once to a small group when I was booked for private training, and I talked to a small group, and they insisted that they just wanted to do kickboxing for fitness. But by the end of the first lesson, they were immediately talking amongst each other saying, yeah, and if something happens tonight, we'll be able to do this and we'll be able to do that. And I had to immediately break up the social conversation and say, no. That's not what you've booked me for. You know, that is not the service. I'm not teaching you that. You know, it's not fit for that purpose. And I'm not misleading you. It's also my duty to do my best to make sure that you're not misleading yourself with whatever I'm teaching you. So it's kind of, you know, an understanding that. But again, that's why I've ended up becoming like that. I've become very service driven. That's my view, is to, if I can start with that. But that's why. But again, that's difficult with running a club, because you're dealing with loads of people coming in to run a club. And, you know, of course, the other problem with that happens is, going back to my corporate advice and my business advice back when I tried to run a club and start with the kids, the sales pitch that a martial artist will give is that it's the equivalent of a car salesperson saying, this vehicle I'm selling you is one of the most economical, yet fastest, yet safest yet most spacious vehicles on the road. You can't have it. You can't have it. You can't have a car that's, you know, that's faster than a Ferrari, yet as safe as a Volvo, but also, you know, as but also as spacious as an Arctic lorry. You know what I mean? It's you're just not. It is not going to exist. You know, so you can't do that. So I'd much rather be able to be the salesperson, the car salesperson, to be able to say, well, what do you want? It's for your family. Well, there's a nice estate here. There's a nice 4x4. You know, you need to do off-roading. There's a nice 4x4 here. Mm. Oh, you want something sporty? Well, okay, let's go to the sports cars. You know, and that's the same. You know, to be able to do that with what I teach, somebody comes to me, go, well, what do you want? What's your purpose? That's why I give them a question. Questionnaire. Yes. What's your purpose? And this is what we're going to do. And you know, and it'll sneak in. No matter how many times you tell them, they will try to mislead themselves a bit as well, particularly because that's the nature, it's the weird nature of combat. Yeah. But it's also, again, it's martial artists and think, and as self-protection teachers, we need to be very honest about our what we can provide and what our limitations are as well. You know, and I often say, you know, martial arts. Even not non-self-protection martial arts, their main purpose is dealing with violence, is managing and dealing with violence in some shape or form. And they might say to you, but no, it's not. It's a spiritual quest. No, it's not. It's about discipline. No, it's not. It's about philosophy. And you're going, no, that art at its root was about hurting people. I'm afraid it was about actually physically hurting people. And you want to talk to me about discipline? Yeah, you can get discipline from learning a martial arts. You should get discipline. Martial arts should provide you discipline. It's, you need discipline to be any good at it. And the same applies for self-protection. You do need discipline. However, it is not the best and most efficient way to learn discipline. You know, there are places that are far more disciplined than we are. I would say in a competition of discipline, the top dance schools in the world beat the top martial arts schools in the world hands down. If you don't believe me, watch a ballet production, watch a any form of long dance production, and the time and hours they put into rehearsing and doing that dwarf the average martial arts class. Or if you want, you know, the best, if you like, they're just non-stop. They get involved with doing that, you know. And you know, philosophy, well, go straight to the root. You know, you don't need a martial art to teach you philosophy. You know, what happened to be was that there were martial arts teachers that happened to be interested in philosophy, or there were martial arts teachers who happened to also be philosophers. Mm. You know, it's again, coming back to the analogy with the cars, it's like the equivalent of having a car mechanic who happens to teach, car maintenance as well. And therefore, you then make the conclusion that by learning a martial art, you'll be better at fixing your car. You know, it's as crazy as that with the philosophy. You know, the philosophy part of it is, you know, you can have a philosophical outlook on a martial art, but the martial art does not provide you with the philosophy. It is an extra. It's an add-on. And it's a modern belief as well. It is a relatively spoken modern belief. That came from China. You might want to go back to Japan's favorite serial killer, Masashi Miyamoto, and say, well, he was a philosopher. Yeah, he was when he couldn't kill people anymore. Then he started getting very philosophical when he wasn't dueling with people and fighting in wars. And then he got philosophical, which, you know, it tends to be a reoccurring theme with fighters. You know, they tend to be, when they can't no longer dish out the punishment, then they start getting peaceful and philosophical. You know, that tends to happen all the time. And truthfully, he did that. Yeah. And he ended up being a decent philosopher, I suppose. And, you know, the Book of Five Rings is a great book. Although it's a book on kendo, you know, it is not a book, you know, and you keep looking at it and you go, you still have to look at it all as metaphors. You know, he's talking strategies and all that, but the bottom line was, the point was, he was teaching kenjutsu. You know, that's what he was, you know, that's what the Book of Five Rings is all about. And I know he wrote other philosophical works as well, but yes, so that's the same thing. So when martial arts comes back to fun, be honest about our limitations. What are we dealing with as martial artists and as people involved in self-protection? And if you can't, and you haven't got certain things to teach a person, I know a really, really good sound protection teacher who straight out said, I'm not going to teach any form of knife defense. What I'm going to do is I'm going to bring in somebody who I know has got proper experience in dealing with edged weapons. And he booked that person in rather than trying to wing it, you know, in his particular thing, which is, you know, admirable. So, yeah, again, we have to do there. Be limited on what we can give. You know, someone comes and says, well, you know, I want to do, you know, there's a lot of karateka that I've been working with who are bringing in the self-protection into that. And they're moving into practical karate as well, which is, you know, because karate began as a self-defense system. And although these individuals understand that it has become an art and they don't want to lose the art, they still want to teach pragmatic karate, you know, and they've come to the conclusion they haven't got a place for point sparring, and they haven't got a place for semi-contact continuous sparring. They haven't got a place for that because it doesn't, you know, they want to be teaching practical karate and they want to be teaching self-protection. And whereas those two have got a relationship and an overlapping relationship, even if they're different at certain times, they understand that this is now bringing something else in that is another skill set. But then I know a Taekwondoan who is excellent and gets all the distinctions and does that, but says, you know what, we do sport Taekwondo as well, but we teach it as a separate, it's a separate thing that we do contained it. And again, I know some people who also go, don't teach pragmatic martial arts, but they have self-protection as a set thing, as a side thing. I say, my personal view, I don't teach a traditional martial arts, so I'm not worried about the pragmatism. I'm straight into teaching mixed martial arts and its component parts. And I teach self-protection as an option, you know, so, you know, that's what comes to me. And I have to say that in recent, it goes through phases. I went through a stage when a lot of my clients were people seeking out self-protection. But at the moment, the main stuff I'm teaching now is competition-based training, you know, and self-protection is taught as a seminar or workshop. You know, it's normally from instructors and who want me to, or parents who want me to teach a seminar or workshop or to a school, like a self-protection course I'm teaching to a school. And it works like that. Most of my regular clients, they either started with self-protection with me, they did the 10-hour course and they've gone, what do I do next? And I've gone, well, I'm not going to teach you more self-protection unless there's a specific field we want to be discussing, you know, there's like weapon awareness or, you know, something like, or you're getting involved in something like security or anything along those sort of lines. You know, so if you want to do that because it's something that is very specific to you, you know, you've done a general self-protection course, well, let's say you're going on holiday and you really want to look at it from a travel safe perspective or something like that, well, we can do that. But in most cases, it's a case they've got to the end of their 10-hour course and they're going, well, I enjoy this. I enjoy this physical combative area of the training. I've done the self-protection. I go, okay, well, that's down. Let's do some boxing. Let's do some Muay Thai. Let's do some wrestling. So they start doing courses based on that. And so they become pretty much mixed martial artists in many cases, or they focus on one discipline totally. That's bound to being service-led, I think, endpoint-led, and honest about what we know, what's available and what limitations we have.
Great. So if people want to, well, get in touch with you, where can they do that and get all of your books as well?
The best hub to go to is the website. So if you go to clubchimera.com, so that's clubchimera.com, clubchimera.com, and you'll see the links to all the social media. Yeah, please subscribe to the Facebook page, Twitter, to Instagram, YouTube channel. I've got videos I put out on the YouTube channel regularly. I have my own podcast as well. And again, that's all you can access all those podcasts through my blog. I keep a blog up to date. All lessons I teach, I make a record of them and they go online. I don't divulge any details of my clients or their names or anything, but the material they cover is up there for both them and for other people, so you can have a good look at what I do and what I teach. Everything is up there, so all the links to all the stuff that's out online, you can get it straight from the Club Chimera website.
Great. It was it's been an honor to talk with you, Jamie, and it's been a long and good conversation about martial arts, self-protection, and
a bit of martial arts.
A bit of martial arts, of course. need to touch on that as well.
I've thoroughly enjoyed myself, Dag. Thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you for having the time. I look forward to listening to more of your future podcasts.
Thank you so much.